This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 18 for March 24th, 2011. We are back again on a Thursday night or a Friday afternoon in Australia. And we are here again together to talk home and technology-related stuff. I am Jim Collison, your host, and tonight I have with me a couple of regulars and a new guest, which I think you will be glad to hear when he jumps in. But let me introduce Andrew Morris. Andrew is our guy down under and in Melbourne, Australia. Andrew, how are you doing almost to the weekend?
Very well, Jim. It's a very cold day down here, and I'm rugging up. So
yeah,
it's
whatever.
We're about to flip seasons.
Yeah. So you're coming out of summer, heading into fall, right? At this point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you know, last 12 hours, it's been raining. It's been cold. So I'm starting to feel your pain.
Yeah. All winter, you've been teasing us with t-shirts and those kinds of things, and it's about time for us to get summer and you to get winter. So we'll see how you make it through an Australian winter. I'm sure. What's the worst of the winter there for you guys in Melbourne?
Worst of the winter where we are, we get, you know, maximum temperatures of probably 13, 14 Celsius. So not that bad. We don't get snow in Melbourne.
Okay. So still pretty temperate.
Yeah, it's pretty pleasant. We're a bayside community, so you know, average altitude's maybe 300-400 feet above sea level.
Okay. Yeah, and that probably keeps you pretty warm.
Yeah, it keeps us nice and warm. It's great.
Seawater. Well, very good. Well, welcome tonight, Andrew. Glad you're with us. Also tonight we have Christian Johnson. Christian, of course, is the stud extraordinaire at biosmods.com, bios-mods.com. And Christian, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing all right, Jim.
Yeah, how's the all the schoolwork? You keeping up?
Yep, on top of it. 2 days to go until closing of the marking period. So
oh, that's nice.
Be able to resume some tech projects.
When does summer start for you? When can I start getting you more full time?
Around June 10th.
Oh, okay, that's not too bad. Do you guys start in September then?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we start like September 10th. It's like yeah.
That's kind of nice.
160 days.
You get through Labor Day, and then school starts. Here in Nebraska, the kids go back like August 14th.
Yeah.
That's kind of that's early.
Yeah. You know?
So, well, welcome, Christian. Glad you've come out tonight. We have a guest with us. He's known over at the Home Server Show forums as DVN. We know him here tonight as Rich O'Neill. Rich, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Pretty good, guys. How you doing?
We are all doing well. Glad to have you on tonight. We've been trying some guests out over the last couple of weeks, and you've been a part of that experiment, and it's been great. We had some folks on last week, and now you're joining us, and so I appreciate you coming out and filling in tonight, and welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Guys, I've been busy this week. We did a big Oracle, you know, at work at my other job. I oversee some Oracle resources, and we had a big Oracle event this week at Gallup, where I work. And we had some 140 people or so between the vendors and the users come out to Gallup for a user group conference today. It was an all-day thing. You know, one of the things that's always a challenge when you're trying to do those kinds of events, you know, you think, you know, what do I use to – I mean, a birthday party is pretty easy, right? You can manage 20 people. But if you're trying to do an event and you're trying to manage hundreds of people, that has been a little daunting, except we found this application out there called Eventbrite. So I'll put that link in the show notes if folks want to go and take a peek at it. But Eventbrite allows you to schedule these local events, and I think – it only charges us if we actually charge for the event, if we actually charge a ticket price for the event. If the event is free, using Eventbrite is free. And they do a little bit of advertising for you. They keep track of your users, so I can send links out to attendees and say, hey, make sure you register, or we can put that registration link in an email. And then they can come back and they register. It gives us a nice download capability to Excel where you can, you know, any information you ask. And you can kind of custom build your invite as well to get their name or company, email, kind of basically anything you want for the event. Tracks it that you can print out little tickets that have barcodes on it. And actually this week one of the guys said they make an Android app now that you can scan the tickets in and it registers the person as attending right there on the site. So, for you guys, I don't know if you guys are organizing events that are of that size or need that, but this Eventbrite worked for us this week. It's a very handy little app, and does a lot of things for you for free that you wouldn't have, that you would normally, I think, struggle to do when you put an event together. Andrew, you do some enterprise stuff. Any need for something like this?
From the enterprise perspective, we've got our own systems. But one of the very cool things I've just noticed with this is when you go to the website, it uses geographical locationing to identify where you are. So when I jump on it, it comes up and picks a suburb that's fairly close to me. So it's obviously backtracking my IP address and gives me a bunch of events that are around my area.
Yeah, mine says,
which I thought was pretty cool.
Popular events in Omaha, because we're in the Omaha area, and then it lists some, you know, it lists the events that are coming up. If you wanted to go out there and randomly look for something to do, you know, I guess that would work.
Yeah, and the curious thing is, when I have a look at the events being shared around, there's an area called Talk of the Town on the website. One of my friends, who I haven't seen for years, has actually got an event that's showing up. So. Not sure if it links into Facebook or not, but she's a friend on Facebook, and it's got her Facebook picture there. So I'm not quite sure how that link works, but that's a pretty cool feature too.
Yeah, and they might even have Facebook integration from a – I haven't even thought about that. Now, we don't use for whatever reason with this enterprise software group, you know, this user group, our adoption of technologies like Facebook and Twitter is very, very low. So today, you know, out of let's say 75 people, I ran a little Twitter contest. And so I said, if you follow the Heartland OUG on Twitter and tweet that you're at the conference, you'll go into a drawing for an iPod Shuffle. And I got five people out of the 75 to actually participate in that. Yeah, that's pretty easy to do. And that's not necessarily bad. It's just among maybe it's the conservative Midwest. Maybe it's the kind of clientele that is drawn or that uses Oracle software. I don't know what it is. They're not the young, you know, the young professionals that are in these fields. It's mostly middle-aged, you know, 40s, 50s like me. Mm-hmm. Professionals, older professionals who maybe aren't drawn to Facebook or Twitter. Which is different to me. I always think the hardcore IT guy, I always think that these guys are on Facebook and Twitter, but maybe not. I don't know. Andrew, you're certainly on, you're on both, right?
Yeah, I am. I look at my peers and the people that work with and for me, and pretty much everyone's on Facebook, but from a Twitter perspective, I don't believe any of my staff use Twitter. If so, I haven't been able to find them to follow them.
Yeah.
A lot of the developers in my clients' application space do use Twitter, but very few of my techos use Twitter.
Okay. So
whereas everyone's into the Facebook thing to, you know, catch up with old friends and, you know, a bit of social voyeurism. But aside from that, I think, you know, Twitter's still coming away, I think. Yeah. I think people are still need to adopt it if they're gonna move down that path.
Yeah. Hey, Rich, we don't know you very well. You haven't been on the show before. Are you a Facebook or Twitter guy at all?
I'm a Facebook guy because my daughter puts pictures up there of her daughter, my granddaughter. Okay. So I kind of coerced into doing that. Twitter, I have a few people on the account, and I'm not really. So, I mean, I check it periodically. I think it's interesting, but I just – don't spend a lot of time with it.
And what do you, Rich, what do you do kind of for a living? I mean, where how do you fit in professionally to the IT world?
I don't actually. Oh, really? I'm just all self-educated. I have a brother who's a programmer, and he and I built the first computer together, which I think is part of my bio on the website.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it's time to get going here, you know. So
yeah, okay. All right. And so you do some Facebook, not so much on the Twitter.
No, not so much on the Twitter.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm finding that. Christian, we've talked to you several times, and I know he's on the phone, so I won't throw it over to Christian at this point until he comes back. I know Christian does Facebook, and I think he was – no, he resisted. Did he resist on Facebook, or did he – I can't remember. He was pretty proud that he wasn't on one of those social networks.
I think Christian's been resisting Twitter.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're right. When I've asked for a Twitter address, he says he's been holding out. So anyways, I found that kind of interesting. And I guess in some of the shows that some of the other podcasts I listen to, they talk about Twitter a lot. And for my friends on the West Coast, that seems to be more popular. But Christian, now that you're back, Facebook, Twitter, are you – you've officially given in, right, to both?
I've officially conceded to Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah, and so, you know, I don't know where Twitter's going, but – or if it'll ever become as big as they think it will. It certainly seems huge. But anyways, from this event perspective, a very helpful – little app, Eventbrite. If you're an average guy and you're scheduling or trying to schedule an event for anywhere from I'd say anywhere from 20 to 2,000 people. I don't know what the cap is on that for the free version, but it's something that we use. I actually have a guy who is on the board who actually does all the Eventbrite stuff for us, and he just gets really good results out of it. And it's just very simple to use, absolutely free. So if you're struggling to schedule something, give this Eventbrite a try. Speaking of Eventbrite and Twitter, one of the guys asked me to talk about as well this week was paper.li. Now, as I say that, have you heard of that before, paper.li?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah. I'm curious about it, so I'm interested to see where you're going to take us on this one, Jim?
Well, a couple years ago, I sat down with some guys, and I was talking about kind of the next stage of Twitter. Maybe not a couple years. Let's say a year ago. And Twitter is pretty useless if you try and do it from the web, right? I mean, it's just a mess. And so if you're trying to do it from something like TweetDeck, it gets a little better. But I'll be honest with you. With my Twitter feed now, I get two or three tweets, maybe more, a minute at this point. It's just if I leave my Twitter feed on, you know, if I go to the Twitter website and just leave it there, and it won't automatically update, but it will tell me how many tweets are waiting for me. And sometimes I can come home with 500 or 600 or 700 tweets, right? Now, I only follow a couple hundred people. I mean, it's not – I follow all the major ones.
Yeah.
Right. So Twitter's kind of become unmanageable from the website perspective. So – what this paper.li does is allow me to kind of create my own newspaper-like looking page that aggregates the tweets from the people that I follow. And so I can go in there and like a newspaper on a single page, or what I've called Twitter aggregation. It allows me to kind of go in there. It's easy for me to read my Twitter stream with some kind of sanity. So I don't know all the mechanics behind it. I don't quite understand how they necessarily rank what gets put on there and what doesn't. But for me, it's a one-page deal that allows me to look at my stream and get some kind of idea what's going on in it. And I imagine the more articles that are similar, the more things are tweeted or retweeted, that pushes the articles up to the top of the page and ranks them in more importance. So it does help me understand my Twitter stream a little bit better.
I thought it was something totally different.
Really?
Because I see your tweet every day that the average guy is out on paper.li.
Yeah, so mine's called The Average Guy Daily.
Yeah, yeah. And I've looked at it and I've thought, I've had a bit of a look at the feed and I've thought, are they tweets that Jim's favorited?
Oh,
so I thought it was an aggregator so that you favorite a tweet and then it ends up in a stream so that other people can see what you're favoring for the day.
Yeah, no. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, no, I did too.
Yeah, no, it's completely based. I don't favor anything on this. It's just completely based on it takes a snapshot, a 24-hour snapshot of my Twitter stream and then aggregates that up into this newspaper-like view. And and so it does. It is based. I think I follow 307 people as of my last. And this runs. I think it generates every 24 hours.
Right.
And so it runs. It creates. Then it starts to group my tweets that I follow by category. So I've got a headlines. I've got a technology. I have arts and entertainment. I have stories, business, education, and then some hashtags that show up. And I imagine this too is kind of a ranked /. Most number of hashtags, but in this case, for whatever reason, the two most popular hashtags that I'm that are in my last 24 hours are HP. So there you go, Andrew. A little bit of HP following for you.
We love to say that.
And WP7. So I must be following folks where there's a lot of Windows Phone 7 and a lot of HP hashtags going on. Yeah. So at this point, I've subscribed to it. I get it daily. But one of the things I like about it is other folks can come in and subscribe. Andrew, you must have subscribed to my paper because you could probably get a notification every day that says, hey, the average guy daily is out, right?
No, it tweets out. So I get your tweet say that it's out every day.
Okay. And I've done it in the past where if I subscribe to it, I get an email saying the average guy daily or whatever. I follow Brian's page at Mystic Geek. So his is the Mystic Geek Daily. So I get an email every day that says the Mystic Geek Daily is available to me. I can go in through the link and bring it up. So kind of, you know, guys, I'll be honest with you, kind of a where I think the future of Twitter is going, following the stream natively is just – it's impossible. I mean, beyond 50 people at this point, you just can't keep up with Twitter. We're going to have to continue to find ways for Priority Inbox and Gmail. We're going to have to find ways for the important tweets to find their way to the top and the junk to make its way down to the bottom, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't follow anywhere near as many people as you do on Twitter, but I know if I turn my phone on of a morning, I can scroll back, you know, 300-400 tweets before I can come back to where I was previously. And I sort of wonder to a degree how much of it's important to me, but then I also think if I don't go back and have a bit of a scan, then the reason I'm using Twitter becomes void, because you use it to I guess have an interest in what other people have to say.
Yeah.
So if you're not looking at what other people have to say, then you know you're better off just deleting your account.
No. Christian, what was your hesitancy on Twitter?
Just the usefulness, really. Like, what am I going to get out of this? And I guess I realized that being able to post new releases for BIOS mods and be able to post new news there kind of got people involved in a different way that I didn't really think would have made a difference.
Yeah, I think you have a great point. Go ahead, Andrew. Oh, I thought you
were... I was just going to ask is... Since you've gone to Twitter with the BIOS mod stuff, Christian, has it improved the traffic or the visibility that your site appears to have?
Well, we have been getting more people following us, so I don't know how that's really reflecting the traffic, because the traffic has actually been on a huge spike, but I don't think it's because of Twitter. But, I mean, there's no way for me to separate sources out, really. So I'd have to do some monitoring there.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the things I've liked about this paper is that it, you know, if you read a tweet in its native form, it can be a little jumbled up, right? You kind of have to parse it. Sometimes you have to parse it apart to really understand what they're doing. What this does is takes the link that's embedded in it, goes back to the, because I don't know about you guys, but 90% of Twitter now is advertising some blog post or something on Lifehacker, something on or something on Engadget, something on, you know, wherever, right? Yeah. YouTube. And this pulls it out and pulls that title out and puts it in a readable. I mean, again, it looks like a newspaper with a short little column article on it. That allows me to kind of quickly scan that like I would scan a newspaper and pull out anything relevant that I might. That might be of interest to me along in my Twitter stream. So if I'm going to do the home server show and I'm getting prepped for that, I follow, you know, the hash WHS, which doesn't always mean Windows Home Server, by the way, then it will – I can go to that hash in this, or I can go into the technology section and kind of see the top posts related to the Windows Home Server. It doesn't always work right, and I wish there was some tuning that I could do with it to make it better. I imagine that's coming. In versions of this, but I really think this is the next. I mean, besides Twitter being the first steps to the Borg, I think I think that Twitter aggregation is really the next step for social media and people really being able to follow Twitter. Or I don't know, maybe people just burn out on it. You know, maybe Twitter will just go out.
I think Twitter's too big to just disappear now.
Yeah. I'd have to agree with it.
I think in a way it'd be like if Facebook were to disappear now. I think I think there's just way too much traffic being generated.
It just may be irrelevant. I mean, Christian, is Twitter relevant or irrelevant among your peers?
Not as heavily weighted as Facebook is, by no means. I think there's kind of a certain nick for it, and it's certain groups of people find it attractive for mobile devices, and some people just don't see the use for it.
Yeah. Now, we certainly, Dave and I both, for the Home Server Show and for the Average Guy .tv here, we use Twitter to announce the show going live or whatever, and we get, you know, it gets the intended result, and almost as soon as I tweet, two or three people show up and chat. I mean, it's and if our followers were more, of course, that would be more, but there is some use there, I think, from a technology standpoint of I think it's in a great alerting, information gathering, getting the word out. There's no way you can follow it on the website. It's just not, you can't, that's just useless. You know, that
scrolls too quickly.
Yeah. Twitter.com for me is just useless. It's anyways. So I'll leave that alone. If you want to try some Twitter aggregation or you want to follow me over at – actually, there's a good example of it on the site. So if you go over to theaverageguy.tv over in the right-hand column, scroll down a ways. I kind of buried it towards the bottom. But there is a side banner that says The Average Guy Daily, and you can click through to whatever my most recent one is for that. And if you're interested in following it and trying it, I wouldn't be offended if you didn't. I wouldn't be offended if you followed and deleted. give it a shot and see if that's something that would work for you. Any comments on it, send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. All right, one more thing for me, guys. And normally I would cover this on the Fitness Tech Podcast, but Andrew, since you and I have been kind of talking back and forth about fitness and some Runkeeper, and I know Mike Howard, who we had on the show last week, who's Geek Accountant, has been working on some fitness and losing weight. So it seems like all us tech guys are maybe getting into fitness again. Runkeeper, which is an application that I use on my Android phone, has been very popular in the news. They released their pro app back in January. That was normally $10. They released it for free starting, I think, January 1st. And at one point, it was out downloading Angry Birds. It became so popular, which was kind of amazing all in itself. I've been using it, and it tweets my run, which just drives some people absolutely crazy. So I apologize if I drive you crazy with my running tweets and you follow me on Twitter. But it does help me. They just released on the Android platform a syncing capability between the app on the phone and the app in the on the web. And so if you input it now in the web, your activities, the next time your phone syncs, it will download it, or that's not the right word, it will sync it to the phone, so those results will be there. To date, it's only been a one-way sync, and this is now a two-way sync, which I think is pretty darn cool if you're trying to keep track of things both on the web and on your phone and keep them in sync so you can get them from anywhere. So pretty cool. Andrew, you've been using Runkeeper a little bit for some of the walks you've been doing?
I do. We use it when we walk over night time, and we use it when we've got a local walk that we do that's a bit of more of a bushwalk, so it's called the 1,000 Steps. It's got an elevation change of around about 300 metres over a kilometre, kilometre and a half. And I've started also syncing up with my heart rate monitor. So
yeah,
when we get home, I connect the heart rate monitor up to the laptop via infrared, download the file, and then upload that into Runkeeper's website. So I can then track my heart rate against the elevation change, which is kind of cool. And then then now syncs back down to the phone, so I can look at the whole lot on the phone.
Yeah, it's kind of nice now that that's out.
It is. So it's awesome.
I'm going to give that a shot. We'll cover that in more detail over at the Fitness Tech Podcast next week. Some good. I've been waiting for this to come, and this is one of those technologies that you go, oh, this makes a lot of sense, especially if you're into fitness. I'll be honest, the best feature of this thing is I put it in a little spy pouch when it's called a spy belt, when I'm running, and it announces distance, time, distance, and pace every 5 minutes. And so I get this. We call her Jane. That's the name of the voice. but it comes out with it, and it tells you. And it's been really helpful when I'm running to kind of know or get reminded every 5 minutes. And I don't run with earbuds, so I really don't like to do that. And so I can hear it from my phone, and it keeps me on pace and on track when I'm out running. So very cool. Runkeeper, I think that pro version is still free. So folks want to go out.
It is still free.
Yeah, folks want to go out and try it on their iPhone or Android phone. I don't know if they have a Windows Phone 7.
They do. They released Windows Phone 7 about 2 weeks ago.
Okay, good, good. And
one of the things I do find
How about the WebOS, Andrew? Do they got it for the WebOS?
No, I don't think WebOS is that yet.
All right.
One of the things I do find is when we run back down, because we walk up these steps and then we run back down the trails, one of the things I do find is you get some really weird looks from people when your arm starts talking to you.
Yeah.
So when you're out running the trails, it's kind of cool, that is.
It's very cool. So I appreciate it. They also do a really nice job. Speaking of podcasting, they have a video podcast that they do each and every week from their development headquarters, wherever that's at. And they they talk about their development and what they're working on and what's coming up next. They're very open about what they do from a technology standpoint. So if you're kind of wondering what it's like to develop an app for the platforms and get a chance to hear it from the developers that are doing it, go to Ustream and search Runkeeper, and they have a very interesting – depends if you're into fitness or not, but they do have a very interesting video podcast that they do each week, and I'll try and get that link in the show notes as well. All right, enough from me. Andrew, you wanted to talk about some new browsers that are coming out.
Yeah, some of the news this week has been Firefox has finally gone to version 4. One of the main differences is – From what I can see, it's the interface is very different to what we expect out of Firefox. So it's becoming a lot more streamlined. So we've got pretty much the address bar, then your tabs, and all the menu and whatnot all comes from a drop down at the top of the screen. The other benefit is it is now fast. So with our plugins or add-ons on it, Firefox is now probably comparable to Chrome, in my opinion. And I'm finding that it's not too bad. I'm almost considering starting to use Firefox again.
Really? And you switched over to Chrome?
I switched over to Chrome. Around about version 3. So I think Chrome are up to version 10 in the non beta releases.
Yeah.
And I'm almost considering that I might go back to Firefox. Yeah, right. Chrome seems to be releasing a new version probably one every week at the moment.
Yeah, it seems like it. They got to 10 really fast.
There's a large update. There's a large update window going on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frequent update window, I should say.
Right, right.
For Chrome.
Rich, we don't know what you use. What's your favorite browser?
Firefox. I'm laughing at Andrew. Oh. I mean, I'm laughing at Christian and his dad. His dad snuck in a room.
See, my video froze, so I didn't. I was wondering what you were waving at, Andrew, and it must be. I don't see Christian's dad back there, so
he left.
Okay.
So you asked, and it's Firefox, and I'll tell you why. It's because of the add-ins. I use one of my main add-ins to keep myself out of trouble. That I use is NoScript. So, I don't run antivirus. I know that's crazy, but I just don't do it. If I'm running antivirus, it's because I'm testing it. Really, basically.
Really?
I don't run it.
Rich,
don't
go any kids in the house that run PCs?
No, there's no kids in the house.
All right.
So it's just me using my PC and actually there's four other adults in the house with desktops and laptops, and I can't tell you the last time they were infected.
Really?
Yeah. So kind of a sort of a safe web surfing group here. But I like the other thing I like about Firefox is I just love the keywords where you can just hit the address bar and type in HSS for home service show, bang, you go, And that's one thing I don't see that Internet Explorer has. So I like add-ins basically here. Yeah.
Okay,
that's your keywords off your bookmarks, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah.
Well, to me, it seems like Firefox is a little more extendable of a browser. They've got the add-in community is a little bit older. It's been around a little bit longer. Seems like there's some more robust add-ins for it that are out there. I've been a Chrome fan for the last year. I like the simplicity of it. I don't use bookmarks. I don't use shortcuts or add-ins for my browser. I pretty much run them stock, and Chrome has worked well for me. Although I've heard that the speed in IE9 has improved greatly and is rivaling Chrome speed. So I don't know that for sure, but that sounds pretty interesting to me. We're not Sarah's in chat right now, my wife, and she just hates Internet Explorer to the point where she removed all the icons or any semblance of IE from any PC that she's got. So I go to work on those PCs and I'm like, where's IE? I mean, it's gone. Yeah. She's taken it off. Yeah. But she came down this evening and said, "Hey, did you hear IE9 is out?" And I said, "Yeah." Christian, where are you landing at this point?
Well, I don't know what pool I'm in because I loved IE8. It was nice for me. I know the add-ins and all these little cute third-party things are great for a lot of people, but I just want something that works. And IE8 was that for me, so okay. It right. comes on the OS by default, so that's what I used. And I was really excited when I heard about IE9 because of the HTML5 support, and it's the first browser that uses GPU rendering, which means that instead of all the graphics on the page being rendered by the CPU and by software, now it's taking advantage of some of these newer high-power graphics cards to render the page, which is one of the reasons why the pages itself are loading faster than other browsers. And that's part of their new HTML5 API and their new graphics engine. So that was one of the real big attraction points for me. And when I went over to IE9, it definitely had a new look and feel from what Internet Explorer 8 was, but certainly looks very similar to what Chrome is now. So all in all, I'd say the speed has dramatically improved, but my major problem is that it's rather inconsistent for me with certain sites don't behave properly. And like on my site, for example, I've never had a problem using BIOS mods forms with IE8. And when I upgraded to IE9, every time I click make post or reply, it makes that post twice. And that's the only browser or version that it does that in. And I've heard other weird things and seen other weird things where just certain pages don't come up right. And sometimes even reinstalling the same version fixed it. So I really don't have a definitive reason what or where these issues are arising. But there is some inconsistency that kind of concerns me.
Can I ask you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, was that when you were using the beta, or is it still now with a release candidate?
Yeah, this is with the final.
The final.
Yeah, I didn't even run Internet Explorer 9 on this box until the final because I didn't want to be having any issues with not being able to roll forward or back or upside down. So I just downloaded it off beautyoftheweb.com, which was the Microsoft site that promoted it the night of its release, and it seemed to work fine and it still does. I mean, there's just a couple sites it's not quite up to par with, which for a final product and all these new engines, it really should be. So,
all right. So the verdict's still out for you. I mean, at this point, it does sound a little glitchy. Rich, you had mentioned in chat that you think it's kind of been glitchy in rendering some pages.
Well, yeah, it was interesting to hear what Christian said because, yeah, I thought so too. And I don't remember specifically what it was doing. I just remembered, like, good, bad. Well, this is still not good, so.
Yeah, it didn't give you the feeling of completeness in it.
Yeah, it was rendering some pages in an odd way, or it wouldn't render parts of a page.
Well, I'd say they made a really good jump forward technology-wise. They just didn't take the extra time to get those last-minute small bugs out that are really, really annoying and can turn someone off a great product. And the other one that Rich reminded me of was I've had weird issues where I can't click links. It's the most ridiculous thing possible. The mouse changes to the I want to click the link, and it doesn't let me go to the new link.
I've noticed that too, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so now the fundamental feature in web browsing, using links, HTML4 there, boys. Not completely working. So,
do you think that's a matter of HTML5 or just the way they're implementing it in the browser?
Oh, who knows what they've done. The point is that for a full team who's been spending time on this to let it go to waste because they can't figure out how to make links work is pretty sad.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's good advice. I'll be honest with you. Up until this point, I haven't done much thinking about IE9. I haven't downloaded it. I didn't try the betas. I've just had so much going on. I haven't messed with it. But if I'm listening to you guys and your experience, I'm waiting at this point. I'm going to stay on 8. I use 8. I use both browsers, and here's why. So when we're doing the show, I need access to my Gmail account, that is, you know, which is my personal Gmail account. And then I need access to my home, my average guy Gmail account, right, because we keep the show notes in it. Well, you can't keep two Gmail accounts in different domains open in the same browser, right? It's always going to want to switch one to the other. So I open one in IE and one in Chrome, and I can do some side by side at that point. Now maybe there's a better way to do that, but that's what's worked best for me in keeping track of show notes and having, you know, two different Gmail accounts or domain accounts open at the same time. That's worked real well. So 8, I have no problems with 8. It seems to work well for me. Chrome 10 works great. I'll be honest with, you know, Andrew and Rich. I don't have room for a third browser, so I don't use Firefox.
Yeah, I don't have it on my production machine. It's just
I have
my,
no problem.
Yeah. Safari every once in a while, but actually the averageguy.tv looks best in Safari. So if that's not the weirdest thing ever, for whatever reason, the website looks really good in Safari. All the fonts render correctly. It has the best spacing. I don't know why, but it looks really good in Safari. So it's one of those kind of things you go, but I'm not switching to Safari, not a chance. So
the thing I didn't like about Safari was that it installed without asking me with the Apple's with the software update with iTunes. It's like, don't install stuff without asking my permission.
Are you sure it didn't at some point have a check?
Well, it gives you all the checkboxes, but it checks the checkboxes by default. So like you open iTunes and then like 5 minutes later, the update panel goes up and like you see iTunes like, okay, I'll hit update, and then you don't see like Mobile Me control panel and Safari and what other wonderful, fascinating Apple products.
Flightware that it installs, exactly.
One of the big things with now you got me going.
Go.
One of the big things with the iTunes update is that be careful. Check your event viewer for Bonjour service errors, because I've seen them bring computers to its knees because the Bonjour service is part of the iTunes QuickTime runtime interface. And what it does is it's just a network program that pulls devices that are iTunes capable or just network devices in general it pulls for. And recently the later the version was, the more problems I personally had with Bonjour in Windows 7. So on my sister's laptop, she had updated iTunes, and all of a sudden, month goes by, and you can barely use the thing without it freezing up. And we checked Event Viewer, and it was logging 20 errors per second in Event Viewer because of the Bonjour service, which not only ties up your I/O disk space, but just clutches CPU power for no reason. So if you do any iTunes updates, A, make sure you're not getting those errors. But just disable the Bonjour service altogether, because you're not going to need it, and you're not going to want it to run on your computer. Rich brings up a good point, though, that the HP MediaSmart servers do use the Bonjour service, so there is some networking functionality that servers may need. But even so, if you don't need it, cut it. If you need it, make sure it works.
Yeah, that's too bad. You know, that Bonjour used to be a really good, back in the day when it first came out. If you had trouble networking things together like printers and other things, that would help you. And it was a light, you know, a little light application that was just, I used to load it by default on a lot of things if I was sharing printers across the network because it would discover things so easily and quickly. But it sounds like maybe it's gotten a little out of control. Yeah, and I think they use it on the MediaSmart for the iTunes server. So that's what broadcasts the iTunes stuff across the network. Okay. So I could be wrong on that, but I think that's why they use it. So it's certainly out there. Well, that's good advice, Christian, on that. If folks see that, it's you got to be careful with the updates because the check marks or the check boxes can certainly matter when you're installing stuff. Christian, since we're talking about browsers, let's talk a little bit about Chrome 11 and its beta form, and you've got a note there. Why don't we talk about that?
Right. So, yeah, Chrome 11 beta is available for download now, and one of the new major features that I thought was cool is text-to-speech. And, you know, the idea of text-to-speech isn't new, but in the browser, that is pretty new. I mean, I explore or anything off the top of my head. I can't really think of any other browser that has that going on right now. Maybe I'm wrong, but what I do know is that Google's speech API is just phenomenal. I mean, it definitely contends, if not exceeds, Microsoft's current speech API. And especially like if you've used the voice or text-to-speech with the Google Maps on your phones, it's very accurate with pronouncing street names. There's really very little room for error when you're giving it directions. So this would be the same API that they're now going to integrate within the browser itself, which I think is a nice addition to what Google did with auto-detecting if the language is in English or whatever your default language is. It auto-translates the page. That was very cool as well. So I think they're really getting up to a new level of accessibility with their language, both text-to-speech and translating with different languages. So I think actually I'm going to give that a try and see where that goes because I have to use Chrome now to do posts on BIOS mods and kind of fill in the gaps where IE9 is not toeing the mark. So I'm hoping Microsoft does push an update, but I think Chrome 11 is going to be a nice toy to play with and see how it progresses.
Yeah, we were talking before the show started about the implementation of text-to-speech or speech search on an Android device, and it is just dynamite. I don't know how many voice commands there are, but my favorite one is navigate, right? So navigate to, say the address, it finds it almost every time. And I did notice on my Sprint phone, excuse me, that if I have low bars, you know, 0 or 1, it will struggle to get that speech converted,
right.
You know, but if two bars are above, it finds it. And then it was just one of those things the other day where I put in the name of the business and it found it and it moved right into Maps and fired up. And within a few minutes I was off and headed to my direction. So that's fantastic. And so this is coming at the browser level. So if I have a microphone on my, if I got a microphone on my PC, I can invoke that from inside Chrome 11. Is that right?
No, it's not speech.
It's coming the other way.
Gotcha. You want it to read the web page you're looking at.
Got it. So it's that voice. It's that annoying, maybe not so annoying voice that reads it to you.
Yeah. And can you pick your own voice, Christian?
Not sure about that, but I know the Google Speech API has. I'm trying to remember how machine-like it is, but I know they're definitely one of the better voices. And even with the Windows stuff, I mean, the choices are pretty limited. Like UK Microsoft, I think Michael or something like that, and Microsoft Dan, you know.
Microsoft
they sound like,
Michael.
They sound like someone put a squeak box in their throat and are trying to figure it out.
You know, I did some training this week at work that was, you know, all online audio training, and it had one of those, somebody sat down and wrote all the slides out, and then it just read the slides to you, and it used that text-to-speech technology, so you could put anything in there, and it wasn't bad. I mean, you could tell it was text-to-speech, but it was, for 45 minutes or to an hour of training, it was fairly tolerable, so it is getting a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's certainly not SAM 64 back from the Commodore 64, is it, where it's very stilted, broken, you know, phonetically spelt words.
It's getting pretty good, and I can imagine it's only going to get better, you know, from the, this point. And listen to Watson on Jeopardy, right? I mean, that voice was pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
You guys heard that, so. Cool. Christian, anything else on that?
No.
I understand you got a deal of the week, too.
Yes, the deal of the week. So we're moving out of the CPUs from last week into Samsung SpinPoint F4 drives. Amazing, amazing hard drives. $90 on Newegg right now. And we were all pretty surprised because we bought three or four of these drives when we used them, how high the performance is for a 5400 RPM drive. They stay nice and cool. They don't overheat. You can keep them in servers and use it as part of your RAID configuration. It averages around 100 megabits per second read-write speed, I believe. But they're just very consistent drives, good temps, and high performance. And a lot of people have been buying them. I mean, it's not like one of these. I know there's a lot of Samsung. Well, it is a Samsung, but the Seagate and Western Digital hard drives, you know, those are hit or miss with some of their higher performance drives that are Caviar Black and have 7200 RPM and large caches. There's a good chance that a lot of those drives, you have a higher chance of RMA, dead on arrival, or just dying after a couple months. But so far, we've had these drives in for about 4 or 5 months now, and they're just rock solid performance.
Christian, this is at home?
Yep.
You put them in? You put them in a, what'd they go into?
This is in server 2008 R2.
Okay.
And I think one is in our home server box as well, as a data backup source.
You know, I've gotten kind of lazy with drives, and I've fallen back into the old Western Digital trap, and that's probably saying it a little too strong. But I've kind of defaulted, for whatever reason, I think because we've been talking about them so much on BYOB and the Home Server Show, I just think of Western Digital. I guess I should be thinking a little outside the box, and you know, Samsung makes some great equipment in other areas around phones and TVs. I can't see why it wouldn't make a good hard drive here.
Well, yeah, we were in the same boat. We were always testing either Seagate or Western Digital hard drives, and we were starting to get like these 2 terabyte drives that were just dying, especially in that dinky EX485 MediaSmart server. I mean, the actual enclosure space is so small. The heat from those hard drives built up really quick, which is why we think some of them died. But
okay,
the Samsung F4s are just rock solid. And like I said, I mean, they're not really considered a major hard drive company, and they've really stepped up their game to something where we actually are using more server drives that are Samsung than we are anything else now.
Yeah, this particular drive too, a bunch of us at work with our home servers were looking for a drive with a good cost point but also a good performance rating and good overall review on the internet. And these drives, we've almost been able to or almost been unable to get stock of them because they're so popular out here in Australia.
And these are standard 3.5-inch drives?
Yeah, 3.5-inch, 5400 RPM, 2 terabyte green drive.
Okay. Right. Yeah, and I guess what threw us off is, you know, you wouldn't think 5400 RPM is really that fast anymore, but that's not the case with these. An Easy PC asks if they're good for Macs. Yeah, they're regular SATA drives, SATA 3 megabits per second, so you can put that in any SATA supported device. So
interesting. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
We've found them. Yeah, just second to none. I mean, compared to some 7200 spin drives, these things outperform some of them.
That's some good advice. I guess, like I said, I thought I'd just fallen into a rut thinking Western Digital on drives. And you know, when I did some of the testing of the Drobo, Drobo sent me all Western Digital drives. So I have, you know, I've got 2 3-terabyte drives, 2 1.5s, 2 1s, and yeah, I guess that's what they sent me. So, and they're all Western Digital. So I don't know, that kind of changes my mind maybe a little bit. Maybe I need to take a peek at Samsung next time I'm buying something.
It's not that bad.
Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm using one as my OS drive in my Media Smart server. And I basically chose it based on performance and the fact that it was, you know, kind of small, relatively small, which I figured would help me with the heat. Not that I have a lot of heat issues, but, you know, it's something I like to try to keep an eye on. So, yeah, I settled for this Samsung. It's a SpinPoint F4, and it's HD 32, 322 GJ. It's a 7200 RPM drive, and it's fast. I mean, I put up benchmarks on this thing when I first got it, and I don't know, is it? I think it's maybe around 130 megabytes, megabits, right? Megabits.
Which one is that, Christian?
Yeah, help me out here. I forget.
Megabytes.
Okay.
Yeah, megabytes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was faster than the Seagate that came with it by about 30. So wow. I just says, yeah, but, you know, roughly, yeah.
Yeah.
And it runs cooler. That's the main thing. I was looking for something to run a little bit cooler. So,
Christian, yeah. For the link that you have in there, is that a full height hard drive as well as far as, you know, the height size, or are those smaller in height?
They're pretty similar to the other drives.
And what's the size? There's a 2 terabyte?
Yeah, all the ones we've been using are 2 terabyte drives.
Oh, very cool. We'll have to check that out. Mm-hmm. And price-wise, right up there with everything else, right?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, I mean, these drives probably even a bit cheaper with the same grade of, not like, burn the house down performance, but I mean very high performance, stable drives. So
for most folks, it would, for the average guy, right, work just fine.
Yeah,
very cool. All right, we'll drop that link in the show notes as well, and folks can come back and take a peek at it and see if they want to take a run at it. You got a speed tip of the week for us, something you did last week, and actually your speed tip last week was kind of crazy. We all went and did it right away, and Andrew, you did it, I think, even before the show was over. And
I've got a PC that sits beside me, and the thing boots up faster.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? So good job, Christian, on the speed tip of the week. What do you got for us this week?
So yeah, I don't know if we're already on the hard drive tangent, so I figured this speed tip was applicable to the situation. Speed tip for Vista XP Windows 7. Stop the thrashing on the drive. So I say, okay, how do I stop the thrashing on the drive? So normally if you come out of if you're starting up from a cold boot, you'll notice that first 3 minutes, literally your hard drive light does not turn off. It's just solid, or it's flickering really rapidly. So to resolve that, you have to turn off indexing on your hard drive. Because what is that doing? So indexing is what makes the search database on your computer kind of robust and quicker. So if you're searching for a document or a program, this index allows you to attain your search result quicker. So for someone like me, I mean, occasionally I'm searching for something, but it's not like every single time I am on my computer, I am searching for a document. I mean, it's not very common for me. And by completely disabling index, you can still use search. It's just it'll take a couple seconds longer. But the amount of seconds you're losing when that computer starts up is way more than just a few, because to maintain such a large index and database is quite taxing on the hard drive and CPU. So if you turn it off with right-clicking your operating system drive and going to the properties and uncheck the allow files on this drive to have contents indexed in addition to file properties, that's going to be the first step. And then you want to go into your services.msc and make sure the indexing service is set to disabled, and you will notice a considerable, you know, it's not as much as the boot caterpillars or your boot time in that regard. It's, you know, once your taskbar starts loading and you're just getting into the actual operating system, you'll notice that time to be able to start using your PC is much reduced.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed that the indexing is not, when I'm searching a non-indexed drive, it with today's modern CPUs, just not even an issue anymore. I mean, it used to be 5 years ago. That's just been my experience. So do we really need indexing? And is it turned on by default in Windows 7?
Yes, it is. So,
yeah.
So if you want to stop the thrashing, you need to go in and turn it off.
Right, which in the long run, if you think about it, especially for people with SSDs, you're adding life to your hard drive. So,
yeah, it's true. Yeah. Doesn't indexing get turned off with an SSD by default?
No, I don't think so. I think all of the SSD tweak tools you download will do something with that. It'll shut it off.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I was listening, I think, Windows Weekly, and Paul was talking about SSD. I think this was 2 weeks ago. I'm ready to go out and buy one for my laptop. I want the speed. You know, I want the speed improvement that comes with that. You know?
Yeah, well, I just threw a 60-gigabyte Mushkin in my laptop. This is like a Acer laptop I got for $299. Okay. It has HDMI built in. It's single core, believe it or not. But $299, I says, okay, I'll buy this Windows 7. I stuck the hard drive in it. I'm telling you guys, this thing boots so fast. I don't know how many seconds. It's just
wow. It's
unbelievably fast like something that would by most people's standards is underpowered. So
yeah, Andrew, I just bought that DM1, right? That HP DM1. And that thing would just rock with a SSD drive in it. It's already pretty fast with the spinning drive in it for a little netbook. But, you know, a 60 gig SSD in that thing would make it even a little bit lighter. And I could just – I mean, I could carry it around anywhere.
Looking at Notebook Review, the guys that have put the SSDs in them, you know, rave about them even more once they've got the SSD in them.
On the DM1s?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine the SATA controller would take full advantage of the speed.
It does.
So, yeah, that would be a perfect candidate, I would think. Rich, a couple weeks ago, I bought an HP DM1Z directly from HP, and we've been talking about it on the show a little bit. So it's been one of those little laptops that gets just – and I imagine the battery life has been really good, 4 or 5 hours pretty consistently on that thing, maybe 6 if I'm not doing much. I've gotten up to 8. On real light usage. I mean, ridiculous.
Wow.
Crazy good on some of the battery life. But I imagine would that SSD give me even better mm-hmm. battery life?
Yeah, you'll get a boost a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's where I could see using that thing because...
Well, the other thing about that is if you bump your, you know, or drop your laptop a little bit, I mean, you're not going to crash your hard drive, are you?
Right on. Well, and lately I've been doing a lot of work around the building, and it requires me walking from my office maybe to another floor. And I don't want to close my laptop and then get to that location and open it back up and bring it out of sleep or hibernation or whatever it goes into when we do that. And so I carry it open. I mean, I carry it like a platter open as I'm walking across. And I think at some point I am going to just – drive that head right into the cylinder and that laptop's over and people look at me funny, but it allows me to immediately go back to work. So I get to another location, I set the laptop down and I just go right to work. Well, with solid state, I just wouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Yeah, it's true.
But how come
yeah.
your laptop takes so long to come out of sleep? Mine takes about 2 seconds and it's back to desktop.
I think it was a bad Windows 7 image and I just got a new image on the laptop 3 or 4 days ago, and I haven't tested it since I got the new image back. So it's quite possible that I got a bad image to begin with, a bad Windows 7 image that didn't have the right drivers installed or something. It's a Dell laptop, so it should work pretty well. But still, it's horribly convenient to just pick the laptop up, carry it, not shut the lid and carry it. And I know that's terrible for it. But.
Well, you're going to like the way your apps load. I mean, things just load faster. Word loads faster. You know, your browsers load faster. So,
what was the price point, Rich, on that 60 gig drive?
Well, they've dropped a lot. I don't know particularly about this one, but what was it? $150 maybe? I think it was $149 when I got it.
So 52, no.
It was kind of pricey, but you can get them down closer to $100 now.
Yeah, so. Two. I think when they get to that dollar a gig space, that's a pretty good for me. That's a
good price point.
That's a good. Yeah. That's a price point I want to get in on. And is that 0.002 cents a gig or point? Zero. Sorry, we last night on the home server show, Dave canceled the show, so we jumped in to catch anybody who wasn't going to who didn't get the word that the show is canceled. We jumped in just to let them know the show is canceled. And Christian, we played this audio of this Verizon call where they couldn't tell the difference between 0.002 cents and $0.002, and Verizon said that was the same thing.
Which it is.
Not so much. Well, Christian, good tip. Anything else for Christians? We didn't officially announce Christian's Corner, so I'm sorry about that. But
yeah, got run over. I don't understand that.
That's the thing right there. I mean, you're a musician. Why don't you compose something? On video, why don't you come in playing some kind of music, you know?
I concur with that. I concur.
Yeah, why don't you sit down, Christian?
And why don't you dress up and do the whole deal?
I might do a Charlie Daniel entrance, you know.
All right.
That'd be nice, and then we can play that for Christian's Corner. I figured out how to get the audio right so we can play the track in real time and right on the show so that I don't even have to edit it. So make us a track, Christian, and anybody who is interested, any aspiring musicians who want to try to get their Christian's Corner mix on the show, just send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, and we'll review your less than 15-second clip. Notice the hint there, less than 15-second clip, and see if it's good enough for Christian's Corner. So we'll wrap up Christian's Corner with that. Rich, you had some things you wanted to talk to us about and around some virus stuff that's out there, security and virus stuff. So why don't you
talk about it? Well, I wanted to talk about Stuxnet, I'm going to leave that for just a couple of minutes here
and
talk about something else. One of the things that we were talking about, well, this is virus related, is I've been hearing something about viruses can actually be sitting in the GPUs. Now, I don't know if anybody's heard that.
No,
cricket,
not here. No.
Crickets?
Yeah, no.
Crickets?
We obviously haven't.
Yeah, okay. So maybe somebody – I'm just wondering if anybody else is hearing that. What did I say? Oh, I had a question for you guys. Did you all install Service Pack 1 for Windows 7?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You did. Okay, no problem with that?
No, none here.
No, not any.
I mean, I've had problem PCs, but I mean, they're all finally worked out now.
All right.
Now, I know Brian did. Brian Burgess had some problems when he put Service Pack 1 on that he downloaded from Microsoft, not through the regular update channel.
Okay. All right. Well, keeping with the virus infection theme, I just want to let people know that I received my copy of Mark Rusinovich's first novel, Zero Day, in the mail. And
I was looking at that.
You got to get it. It's kind of funny because, you know, I think it's going to be an okay story, but I'll tell you, it's almost like Mark is sitting there explaining, like, you know, what he explains terms that he's going to use, you know, so he'll say, you know, I can't remember, but, you know, so you feel like you're getting a little bit of a lesson here about the different technologies that he'd be speaking about, and then a whodunit kind of like thing where there's a virus that's been released on the web and it's taking everything down. So good stuff. AJ actually pointed me out to that.
Yeah, one. I subscribe to Mark's RSS feed, and there's been a lot of, he's had 3 or 4 posts in his feed about the book coming up and its release, and I don't think it's hit Australian shores yet, so I'm sort of contemplating if I'll hit the trigger and buy it off Amazon or not.
And what's the name of the book again?
Zero Day.
All right. Yeah. I guess I haven't heard of that. Maybe I've not been listening to the right circles.
Well, it was actually AJ posted it about 2 months ago, and he says, you know, hey, you know, because we were talking about Mark Rusinovich, I think, and he says that he came out with his first novel. I says, I'll put that, I'll buy that, you know. So I went to Amazon, and this is the first paper book I've owned for a long time. Every book I own now is coming from Audible.com. So, okay, look, I'll tell you, I've been looking at this Stuxnet thing. First I heard about it. This is the virus or worm that broke up the some centrifuges in the Iranian plant, nuclear enrichment plant. And I'm going to say this wrong, but I think it's Natanz. I'll pronounce it that way. What it did is it's here, let me look at my notes here. It's basically it's the first virus or worm that got in and actually messed with programmable logic controllers, which are part of it's the machinery that's controlling other machinery, let's put it that way.
Right,
like robots or whatnot, right? So if you need something to control the robot's movement, or in this case, the centrifuges. And what this worm did was it would speed up the centrifuge. Well, it put itself in a thing called man in the middle. So it positioned itself as the man in the middle. So basically, that's sort of like the analogy of like the Hollywood movie where the bad guys take a tape loop and they apply it to the video surveillance system, and the guy sitting at the desk see everything looks normal, and meanwhile they're tearing the bank vault apart and everything. Well, that's what's going on with this. That's what happened with this virus here, and basically what it did is it looked for a signature. It looked for the hardware. And it says, okay, we're in this Siemens controller. It looked for the software. It had to be running this software called Step 7. And once it saw those two things, it looked for one other thing, which is like what frequencies is this controller trying to run these centrifuges at. And once it saw that it was the frequencies that were known, this is the espionage part of it. Somebody had to have leaked out this information about what frequencies these rotors were running at. Once it saw those three pieces, it says, I'm in the right place. Let's do my thing. And what it would do is it would speed up the rotors, and then it would slow them down, and it jerked them all around erratically, you know, like up and fast and then slow. And basically, it tore them apart in a matter of days, maybe weeks. And this was something that was actually, I remember hearing something about Ahmadinejad was talking on the news that he was saying something about how they were having some problems in one of their nuclear enrichment facilities. And this is back in last summer when they were, you know, there was a lot of discussion in the news about worrying about whether Iran is trying to enrich the uranium to the point of nuclear grade. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing how they put this all together. They had to have knowledge of undocumented features of these programmable logic controllers. So how they got that, we don't know. They had to have a way to get this virus to the actual machinery that they wanted to infect. And the problem there is that that machinery is not physically connected to the network. You know, it's sneaker net is the last leg of the infection.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, wouldn't you firewall off pretty severely this reactor, but it doesn't sound like it's connected.
It's not connected.
Yeah.
So what happens is, you know, it goes through the internet. I think what the attackers did was they targeted maybe areas close to that. You know, it's hard to say how this actually happened. It could have been that one of the technicians brought it in, you know, from after searching the web, and he had his USB drive, and then he comes in to work and uses that USB drive to transfer. And you have to have a reason. So what is he doing? He's transferring maybe a firmware update for the controller, okay, because they're always fixing bugs. Mm-hmm. So that was you know, that was the way that it probably got infected, as far as like the impetus to actually take a USB drive from one place and put it into the isolated machinery. And, you know, the things they had to do to, I called Christian and asked him if he would look this over, because this stuff here is really more on a programmer's level. I mean, I find it fascinating. I can sit there and read it, and I can kind of parse it a little bit. But I don't know, Christian, did you have any thoughts about this? Did you look at it?
Yeah, I did. I was very interested in, you know, you were talking a lot about how it was at such a low level that it was at the programming controller chips. And that takes skill to work all your way from an external source down to that level. So I kind of took an approach as to the way I researched it was, well, how does it go about getting down to such a low level? And the big thing I took out of it was that it's the first thing it's going to do is what you said earlier. It's going to check the configuration of the computer it's now on. Then it takes a check and sees whether it's a 64-bit OS or a 32-bit OS. Then it checks the actual operating system name itself, and it checks whether the account that it's been infected onto is an administrator account. So once it gets to that level, it kind of has that collection level. So if it has the admin rights, it's going to go on and start looking at your antivirus software. If it doesn't, it's going to again recheck the OS, and then it's going to infect Win32KSys, which is one of the core Windows drivers, CSRSS, which is a crucial System 32 EXE, and it's going to use Task Scheduler to manage and get all of the things it needs done working.
Right.
So that's how it resolves whether or not it has admin rights. So it's going to have admin rights. Then it gets down to the antivirus stage, and it really has pretty much every software program out there covered. It can detect the antivirus processes that are running, and then it actually chooses the process it wants, and it ejects its first DLL or export code is the term.
Right.
Gets exported into that actual process. So these antivirus programs, which a huge number were targeted, I mean all the major ones, they're defenseless. They don't have a chance if this thing gets on of catching it or really doing anything with it. So really its operating base starts at Windows 2000 and works its way up to the latest out.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the detection routine to go ahead and get all the way down to that level of I've injected myself into your antivirus program and your system drivers. So then the load point, it's going to start going into all your Windows INF installation configurations, and it's going to start putting itself into processes like, so Explorer, you know, Services EXE, all those major ones, then they're crippled. So then it gets down even farther than that. What it does after that is it's called Windows Rootkit functionality. So it's able to hide itself as something that's legitimate because it looks like it's an actual core kernel. It looks like to the operating system it's a part of its core kernel operating system, which is disturbing to say the least.
Can I jump in here for a sec?
Yeah, of course.
Tell me if this is right. This is what I heard about the rootkit technology. Basically, it's an attack on the file system level. And what happens is when a file gets enumerated, it basically says, you know, it says, okay, what's next? What's next? And then it's get ready to look at enumerate the virus. And the rootkit says, move on. There's nothing here. Go to the next one.
Exactly. Right. because it looks.
So your OS never knows because the file system level,
right,
is saying, you know, hey, nothing here.
Yeah, it just basically slides under the fence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. So
that's kind of wicked.
Yeah, and then it gets its own driver installed, so now it can act like a device. And once it's got the driver in, say bye-bye to your computer, because now it's going to use your computer. It's going to use the network browser to see all the other computers you're connected to, and it's going to do the same thing. So I don't even think you have to have login privileges to – it'll just copy to a network share, and then it's already got what it needs to start going through the rest of your network.
Christian, does a complete reinstall then wipe it out at that point?
Yeah.
So if I format right, if I get this right, and this isn't floating around the web at this point, I would assume.
Well, let me just jump in here. Yeah. That's nothing that is going to really affect a Windows machine. The virus itself is not going to kick off. It's not going to trigger in a Windows 7 or any Windows environment except the PLC. The only thing it's using our computers for, Windows computers for, is to transmit itself until it gets to a PLC, and then once it's in that environment, it kicks off.
Okay.
So how much damage it does, you know, from what listening to, I first heard about this on Security Now, Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte, one of those Twit podcasts, and Steve comes out with some pretty crazy stuff once in a while, and he gets kind of, you know, I mean, he's a smart guy, but sometimes you wonder if this is maybe overhyped. Well, I don't think it's overhyped at all. I lost my train of thought there. Take it from there.
Yeah, no. I guess
I'll get back to it.
Yeah, I guess my thing is that, you know, it's scary to me that, you know, your computer is now contributing to the plan that this virus has executed. And really, you know, does it do harm to your data? Maybe not, but I mean, by the time this thing is completely finished its process of execution, you don't have many of your original Windows files left. They've all been modified and infested by this Stuxnet thing. So, you know, who knows what that means in terms of I run a regular program and all of a sudden it doesn't work on my computer. Well, maybe that's because some of the core files that expected to be in a certain condition are no longer like that. Mm-hmm. I guess my concern is that power in numbers, the more computers it spreads to, the easier it's going to be for them to accomplish that. I mean, that's a given. Mm-hmm. But if they've already gotten it down to the point where they're at the lowest level you can get on a computer, they could modify this thing with all the work that's been put into it, which is ridiculous that anyone would want to spend that much time just to destroy intellectual property and physical property for that matter.
Yeah.
But by the time you get down to that level, they can just tweak a few things and target it for whatever audience they want. It doesn't have to be a Siemens controller chip. It can be Jim Collison's laptop because it has an Intel i5 processor that was bought at
How did you know that? How did you know that, Christian?
Yeah. They could do that. That's definitely it. You know, one of the things that Steve said, and a lot of the people have said, it's not so much Stuxnet and the Iranian centrifuge that is the big concern. You know, that attack has already taken place, and it had already taken place by July of last year when they first discovered it. The real problem is that somebody is creating Stuxnet 2. All of these, disgruntled employees, okay, terrorist groups, or, you know, insert other bad guy with bad attitude kind of scenario. And they get a hold of this code, and this time it's going to be much easier. They're not going to have to come up, create the method. The method is laid out right there. You know, if you want to know what the method is, you know, hit the internet, read Symantec's, security response, W32 Stuxnet dossier, or hit ESET's response, or another guy to check out actually in this thing is Ralph Langner, who was at the forefront of the analysis when this took place, when it was first discovered last July. He's very familiar with the Siemens controllers. So, so the problem is that this is fascinating for everything it can do. The real scary thing is that somebody is going to use this to attack other facilities, other industrial settings. So it could be like, could somebody set up something to throw a valve open in an oil refinery? Could somebody, you know, send an infection to a power plant, a nuclear power plant here in the U.S.? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. They run controllers. They run Siemens controllers. I mean, that's not an unusual name if you've ever walked through a, you know,
you're going to say. I think one of the interesting things, though, is a very large – they're taking advantage of a social engineering aspect as well. I mean, if you can make this thing pose,
I think you're right,
as a firmware update or a controller update, then you've targeted a totally different different mechanism for distributing a virus, and that's people. Because I came out of a manufacturing background originally, and you know, we used to run Allen Bradley PLCs, but the only way you could actually get something into the PLC was by physically walking up to the unit and programming it. I mean, these things were programmed with punch cards, but and then we used to dip switch programming. But mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, it still took someone to walk up and physically make a change to the machine. And you know, if you
it's
can't,
what they call air gapped, right? Air gap networking, right? Yeah, sneakered.
Yeah, you know, total physical segregation.
Right. Yeah.
So that's a bit that scares the hell out of me.
This is the thing that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, that you can get past the social engineering aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, here's what I thought about too. Is like, you know, they set this all up so that it's the virus is, you know, the payload is being transmitted through a rootkit that's hitting Windows computers, you know, and it's plugging its way headed toward the Iranian centrifuge plant, right? Well, you know, could that just be a ruse? Because, you know, we've got you to go ahead and actually take that thumb drive that we handed you, and you're just going to walk across the floor, and everything's infected, and so you're covered because it looks like you got infected, you know? So, I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what really happened here, but, you know, the point is once it actually got on the machine, it was able to hide itself. You know, again, that whole movie scenario where you put the loop in the video surveillance camera scenario, you know, the techs were looking at this, everything looked honky-dory. Next thing you know, you got the president of Iran on the news saying, yeah, we've been having some problems, a little bit of problems with our centrifuges, but we'll get there, you know. Well, you know, the problem is that they lost about 1,000 rotors or so, you know.
Someone's just thrown out, Pisces has just thrown out in the chat, you know, is this similar to the beginning of a Skynet out of Terminator?
Well, you know, I made a Borg reference the other, you know, back at the beginning of the show. I think you can take these things out to those conclusions. Who knows? You know, we've got, I remember, you know, think about 1998, 99 when the Melissa virus first came out, and nobody was ready for that thing, and it really did nothing. Someone had said in chat, you remember the good old days when viruses would just, you know, do crazy things on your screen and wouldn't let you, you know, do anything or along those lines. Yeah. And the viruses have certainly gotten, they've gotten smarter. That's for darn sure, and a little more destructive.
They have a purpose.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, you'd mentioned in chat just as while we were talking about this. I mean, it's too bad some of this brilliance in creating, because it is brilliant. I mean, whoever came up with this is brilliant. It's too bad some of that brilliance couldn't be turned into something useful, you know, and maybe this whoever created it thought that they were being useful for whatever reason. But, you know, Melissa was bad back in 99. And I remember, you know, I worked in some place and we had the virus everywhere and it was hard to get rid of. And we got through it and they figured out better ways and networks got locked down more and you know, we figured some things out. I imagine someone's going to look at this, and this was just my optimism kicking in here. I imagine somebody's going to look at this, and I'm sure it's going to destroy more things before it's done. But I imagine at some point there's a force or some code or something that will be able to be applied against this to find it and root it out or discover it or whatever. So
I think you're right to a degree, but I also think that it's worth considering that the people that developed this was a nation state, and it's generally considered that Israel. In conjunction with the United States, and I'm going to speculate since Siemens was involved, you know, who knows, maybe Germany.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just my speculation.
Well, it's a little bit of Cold War action, right?
You got the best and you got the brightest.
Yeah.
Working on this stuff, and you got unlimited resources for all intents and purposes. So,
Rich, I think the danger in this is not necessarily the virus itself, and I look forward to your letters, but is in the fact that so a nation state, let's take your conspiracy theory, right? Let's just say a nation creates this to really, the West doesn't want Iran having a program, right? So they say, fine, we're going to inject some code into your system that's going to break your rotors and it's going to make it ineffective, right? It's a little bit of espionage. I think the danger in it is not so much that, it's the fact that this code then leaks out somewhere in a U.S., say the U.S. government has.
So it's reusable, though.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
We all know nobody can keep a secret. And so how long is it before this top secret code makes its way out of some government, U.S. government installation and finds its way into someone who's not so responsible, and turns that into something, that could be well. That's what scares me the most, because I've worked for the U.S. government and I know how bad we are at keeping things secret and how bad we are at locking stuff up. Yeah. And I'm just afraid that source code will make its way out. Maybe it has already. Somebody in chat had mentioned that too. Maybe it's already made its way out and it could be used on a commercial, air quotes there. It could be used in a commercial application of sort to do some nasty things to.
Yeah.
Deliver payloads, right? Because it in this case, it delivered a payload to a standalone system, but it looks like it's built. It could deliver a payload to just about anything.
Right, and I don't think something of this advanced nature is worried about like infecting your or my laptop. I mean, this is definitely going after targets. Whether it's power plants or, Hoover Dam or whatever,
Or aliens from outer space.
Well, I don't think we can program anything to attack the aliens with our Apple computers. What? I don't know.
What? That was so legit.
Are you making a Jeff Goldblum reference there?
Yeah, I am.
All right. Yeah, that's great.
Sorry, I had to bring a little brightness to the dim dark.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to bum everybody out, but, it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating. I mean, probably anybody listening they're listening because they like technology. I mean, I asked Christian to come in on it so that he could help me remember and maybe figure out some of these things, because Christian's very good with that. But just from a story point of view, it's like, wow, this it's fascinating. It's intriguing.
Yeah.
So it's quite a step. Actually, Ralph Langer, I'll just leave it with this. He said the step that this took, like from the run-of-mill viruses that are out there and rootkits, he says this is like putting a modern aircraft in a World War II theater. He says it's that kind of a jump. Now, maybe he was just exaggerating, but I mean,
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's the next step. I mean, I think if you didn't live through the early days or the late days of the 90s and when viruses really first became popular, if you didn't live through that, like Christian didn't, this could be the beginning of some, the new family of viruses, so to speak, that have some serious implications for, and somebody in chat had mentioned banking, right? I mean, I think that's the most dangerous place, right, for things to do is, what if something gets in there and starts, messing with our banking systems?
Sure.
That could be, or our national security, applications at the Pentagon that are behind firewalls that you can't get to that don't have access to the internet.
That the Chinese don't have a problem getting to.
Right. Yeah. No, right on. I mean, I think it's it might open the doors to some new, and this is, like you said earlier, I don't think the average PC user necessarily it's going to see the effects of this, although it could probably be turned into that by somebody, right? But I think the amount of both governmental and corporate espionage could go up with something like this as folks try and sabotage one another.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like a James Bond. I mean, it is a James Bond movie, right?
I'm telling you, Jim, they could make a movie out of this.
They probably have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
hope the authors get full credit for it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Well, that's real life. You know, real life kind of stuff out there that's going on that we don't, and sometimes we're not even privy to some of the information that comes out about these things. I'm sure there's been other incidents that we know nothing about. So, anyways, Rich and Christian, thanks for taking some time to dig into that. I'll admit I haven't really paid attention to it much, but now it'll have to hit my radar a little bit, and I'll have to kind of think about it a little bit more as I hear about, you know, what's going on. We'll say, hey, I remember I heard it first on the Average Guy Home Tech Show. That's kind of scary.
Yeah, that is kind of scary. Wow, home tech, huh?
Yeah, well, that's good. You know, it's a little bit beyond sometimes what we talk about here on home tech, but I think it's good. I mean, we've had some good chat around this just in the chat room. Mm. And for the folks that are listening, I think there's something good to think about.
Yeah.
Andrew, did you want to say something?
Absolutely. Oh, I was going to say the thing that I find most incredible about all this type of virus, and I mean, you know, to a lesser degree, you look at Blaster and Archie and the other distributed viruses, the ones that distributed themselves.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one in a while. Blaster?
Yeah. And I mean, that, and even, you know, more modern, you know, the Configure virus, the thing that I think that most people miss is the people who write this code, if they were focusing their attention onto real life scenarios, they would be, you know, they're just wasting their talent.
Ultimately
they've got an awesome talent in distributed computing programming. And they're wasting it by writing malicious code.
Yeah. See, we've got a great example in Christian, right? He writes good code.
That's right.
Well, so we think, right?
Good code by day, bad code by night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me it's not true, Christian. You're writing all good code, right?
All good code. It's completely clean. It won't take out Jim's laptop. Might take out the Average Guy site once in a while, but I swear.
No, listen, you don't need a virus to take down the Average Guy site at any time. I can do that with just a few lines of, just by deleting a few lines of code in the site, and down it goes. So anyways, well, guys, we've run a little long tonight, but I do appreciate you guys coming out this evening to engage in this conversation. I hope folks that listen to it could hang out through the extended discussion on this and gain from it. If you have any comments or you want to add to the conversation, of course, you can do that by posting a comment right there on the site. We don't have a discussion forums yet, so you can't go out there, but you can post to the site. You can also send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, if you got some feedback on that and you want to get that in. Oftentimes, when I get notes from folks, I like to read them on the air. So if you want to get your 15 seconds of fame on the podcast, send me a note. Give me some feedback on what we're talking about, and you may get mentioned on the air. Gentlemen, anything else? Andrew, you're smiling, and that always makes me nervous when you're smiling like that.
I'm just a happy guy.
Okay, good.
Okay.
I agree.
All right, that's good. Well, guys, we'll wrap it up for tonight. We'll do it again next Thursday. Rich, thanks for coming out tonight and joining
us. Thanks for having me, guys.
For the podcast.
Pleasure.
If you're open, we'll have you on the show again, and I appreciate your contribution.
You're most welcome. I appreciate it.
Yep. And Andrew, have a good weekend. You're almost already there, so enjoy your weekend, and thanks for coming on. And Christian, always good to have you.
Of course.
And your video froze in the middle of the podcast, so that was a bummer for me. I've just got one picture of you the whole podcast.
I'm sorry. Well, I hope it was a good picture.
I missed your dad. Oh, hey, we got to get your dad, by the way. Talk to your dad. Maybe we can get him to guest here. in the next couple weeks. See if he's open.
Sounds good.
All right, sounds good. All right, gentlemen, have a good evening. This is another Home Tech podcast, and we will see you next week.